talking right about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on the wars we fight, griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're coming down my country and they're walking on the fight beside me. Walking on the fighting side of me, running down the way of life, I'm fighting and falling down deep. If you don't love it, leave it, let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Guy who claims he just don't believe in fight. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count and be free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking. Down with life, I'm fighting in a fallen dive. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You run down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You run down my country, man. You walking on the fighting side of me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program. Here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Well, until we know more about it, I think I'm not going to be making too many comments about the shootings that took place on Saturday in El Paso, Texas, where about 20 people were killed, and then in Dayton, Ohio, where I believe 9 people were killed. Anyway, Donald Trump's daughter Ivanka has become a Jew, as she's married a Jew. And, well, of course, she's certainly entitled to her opinion, and her opinions don't, her father's opinions don't necessarily, represent her father. I still find her comments in the wake of the shooting in El Paso disturbing. Ivanka tweeted her support for the eradication of white supremacy Sunday. She said, "As our nation mourns the senseless loss of life in El Paso and Dayton, and praise for the victims and loved ones, we must raise our voices in rejection of these heinous, cowardly acts of hate, terror, and violence." And then she goes on to say, "White supremacy, like all forms of terrorism, is an evil that must be destroyed." It's hard to know, what does she mean by white supremacy? It's not a form of terrorism. Believing that the white race is superior is not a form of terrorism. A belief is not terrorism. Now, I have quibbled quite a bit with some of my critics up here in Canada who want to call me a white supremacist. And I say, I'm not a white supremacist, I'm a white nationalist, and there is a big difference. A nationalist is one who is proud of his people and wants to preserve them. And not to be too vague about it, what that means is those of us, the founding settler people in North America, Australia and New Zealand, of course, the indigenous population of Europe, Europeans or whites, have the right to be proud of themselves and to preserve our dominance in these areas, in these territories that are our homeland and which we built. That is nationalism. Supremacy means ruling, well, it can mean different things, but the way I think it would be used today means ruling over other people. And I, in terms of white supremacy, although he certainly did not do it in the name of the white race, I see the policies of people like Bush the First and Bush the Second taking America into costly wars for Israel to impose regime change on countries like Iraq and Afghanistan. And that would be trying to impose our ways on theirs, on them. That, to me, is the behavior of a supremacist. And I'm not one. I don't believe in that. Disappointed in Ivanka Trump, but, that certainly an inveterate opposition to white people is characteristic of Zionists. Here's an interesting story about a spokesman for Donald Trump, a close ally of his, the very lovely Kellyanne Conway. And this is fast-talking presidential counselor Kellyanne Conway had no luck changing the topic from migrants to Muslims during a discussion about illegal immigration with Meet the Press host Chuck Todd. Conway's comments followed Todd's suggestion Sunday that President Trump's divisive rhetoric has made discussing the Central American refugee situation difficult. Hard to understand that. He's always discussing it. I think the rough rhetoric this week, respectfully came from the other side. You have this anti-Semitic congresswoman, Conway breathlessly said, in reference to Democratic Congresswoman Ilhan Omar's recent comments that on September 11th, some people did something resulting in the terror attack that killed nearly 3,000 Americans. Good to see Kellyanne giving it back as good as she gets. Here's interesting bit. We didn't hear that much about this one. There's been quite a bit of talk about the shooter or the online manifesto posted by the shooter in El Paso, and I will discuss that probably on a future program. Much less has been published or discussed about the shooter in Dayton. And it turns out, he is an Antifa. The Dayton shooter was a Satanist, a leftist socialist, a Bernie and Warren fan, and supported Antifa or Antifa. This is probably something CNN won't be sharing with its audience, but there's some pretty striking news on the shooter who perpetrated the Dayton, Ohio shooting, which followed an equally tragic shooting in El Paso, Texas. Heavy.com got access to the shooter's social media. Contrary to the media narrative currently boiling over, this shooter was not a Trump fan. In fact, he hated Trump, hated Republicans, was an avowed leftist using Antifa-style language in his posts, and he loved Elizabeth Warren. And let me be quite clear. Elizabeth Warren had nothing to do with his shooting, and I wouldn't want to make such a connection. But here's some of what was found. Bette's Twitter profile read, "He, him, Annie Mae fan, metalhead, leftist, I'm going to hell and I'm not coming back." One tweet on his page read, "Off to Midnight Mass, at least the songs are good. Hashtag atheists on Christmas." The page handle, "I'm the spookster." On one selfie, he included the hashtags selfie for Satan, hashtag hail Satan, and Hashtag Hail Satan Tweety. On the day of Republican Senator John McCain's death, he wrote, Fuck John McCain. On November 2nd, 2018, he wrote, Vote blue for God's sake. Ironically, he was even a rabid supporter of gun control, using it to levy attacks against Republicans. Quote, this is something the shooter in Dayton wrote. This is America. Guns on every corner. Guns in every house. No freedom but to kill. He wrote in December of last year. And tis the pistol. The pistol is a Beretta 93R called the REK7 in BO4. Do love me some guns. He wrote, hammer brick gun. On February 14th, 2018, he tweeted this at Senator Rob Portman. Hashtag Rob Portman. Hey Rob, how much did they pay you to look the other way? 17 kids are dead. If not now, when? That was the date of the shooting at the school in Parkland, Florida. He used language often used by Antifa, exclaiming that he wants to, quote, kill every fascist. He also liked and commented on posts expressing support for the Antifa group. Hashtag 2016 election in three words. This is bad, he wrote. You can't kill 50-plus people and injure 600 in 10 minutes with cigarettes, my dude, he wrote in 2017. In response to a BuzzFeed story that read, Virginia's declared a state of emergency in anticipation of the Unite the Right rally anniversary in Charlottesville this weekend, he wrote, kill every fascist. Betts was a politically active socialist who supported Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. On the Twitter page, Connor Betts indicates he voted for Elizabeth Warren for president, but not Kamala Harris, responding to a person's tweet suggesting they be co-presidents. Nah, but only because Harris is a cop. Warren I'd happily vote for, he wrote. He responded to a person's tweet that read, if you nominate anyone other than Sanders, you're going to lose, by writing, I think Warren has a decent shot as well. Some of his tweets referred to guns. He was a fan of the Squad, including, that's those four leftist congresswomen, including Representative Ocasio-Cortez and Representative Omar. He shared an article that criticized Democratic leaders like Nancy Pelosi for not supporting Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar, and Ayanna Pressler. Read it, he wrote. He shared posts about concentration camps at the border. Cut the fences down, slice ice tires, throw bolt cutters over the fences. He retweeted a post from another person about stealing from right-wingers at a Trump rally. This all leaves very little question about who Betts really was. He was absolutely a far leftist. He was not a white supremacist and hated religious people. He repeated Antifa as well as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez talking points on his social media. He was a global warming enthusiast and an avowed socialist. Every piece of evidence we have points to his radicalization coming via the left, not the right. Very interesting, and as the introduction made it quite clear, this is probably not something we are likely to be getting information about. One of the things we keep hearing about is global warming. And I mentioned this yesterday, Prince Harry giving a speech about global warming at this obscene gathering of the very, very rich in Palermo, just outside Palermo in Italy. People like singer Katy Perry and fashion designer Diane von Furstenberg, the 103 private jets flew into Palermo Airport, some yachts the size of battleships, and so on. People spending obscene amounts of money, and of course, all the while lecturing others about coming down on the use of carbon. It just reeks of hypocrisy. And yesterday I read the commentary by a writer for a Canadian publication, the National Post, who was quite eloquent about this. This was, I thought, extremely well done. This was Rex Murphy in yesterday's paper. Seems to depend on Hughes humor. Here's a South African Jewish comedian mocking white farmers who were brutally murdered by blacks. Daniel Friedman, a Jewish so-called comedian in South Africa, has released a musical video that derisively mocks the white farmers who've been savagely murdered by blacks. In this video by Willem Petzer, we see Daniel Friedman, the editor of The Citizen, who is also a part-time comedian, who thought it would be hilarious to do a comedy scene mocking the victims of South African farm attacks and farm murders. This is nauseating and appalling to any decent person, and his content is disgustingly horrific. And this from an editor in a mainstream news outlet. The Citizen is one of the major English-speaking newspapers in South Africa. Makes one wonder if the 12-year-old boy who was drowned in boiling water after seeing his parents brutally murdered would have found it hilarious, and if other victims who were brutally tortured and murdered would also find it funny, or if a small child who was dragged through her parents' blood by her hair found it funny before she was shot. William Petzer exposes this horrific human being for what he is, and shares information regarding his left-wing opinions. Daniel Friedman has regularly and incorrectly, without factual substantiation, reported false information and false news about Afriforum and others. The Jews of South Africa have been demonizing and subverting the whites for the last 60 years or more, disguising their Bolshevik revolution in South Africa as a philanthropic anti-apartheid human rights campaign. And now that the Jews are firmly ensconced in power, fellow Jews like Daniel Friedman are openly mocking the whites as they are slaughtered on a weekly basis. No doubt Friedman and his fellow travelers have reserved seats on flights to Tel Aviv just in case they need them to get out of town in a hurry. And one of the not very well-kept secrets from South Africa is that some of the major backers of the South African Communist Party and the African National Congress were Jews. In fact, I believe there were 15 terrorists that were arrested in the Johannesburg suburb of Rivonia for planning to plant bombs and other explosives. And this was back in the early 1960s, which resulted in the famous Rivonia trial, which sent Nelson Mandela to prison for a long time as a terrorist. He wasn't put in jail because of his political opinions, and he certainly wasn't jailed because he was black. He was jailed because he was a communist terrorist. Well, Jews, who constitute a small portion of the white population of South Africa, constitute a disproportionate number in the South African Communist Party and in the terrorists in the Rivonia group.
Putting these comments into context, the media and government in South Africa are firmly controlled by the Jews at this point, which is why there is virtually no recognition of the plight of the white farmers. Sure, there are cursory stories about the murders, but they are often characterized as robberies gone wrong, or atypical random acts of violence. In reality, the blacks are the Jewish golem. a Frankenstein-like monster created to destroy the enemies of the Jews, that's the South African whites. And like most golems, the blacks will eventually turn on their creators. So an interesting commentary from South Africa. Now here's one of those stories that is so characteristic of Canada. BC man pleads guilty to human smuggling. And the story will, among other things, illustrate the fact that the present immigration system is just not serious. Subtitled, the man in question helped Chinese migrants walk across the border. No, they're not migrants, they're illegals. A Vancouver man accused of being involved in an elaborate operation that may have helped smuggle hundreds of Chinese migrants across the Canada-US border by exploiting lax oversight at International Park pleaded guilty to several offenses on Monday, just before his trial was about to begin. Michael Collin, 62, wore a red jumpsuit and leg shackles, and when BC Provincial Court Judge Patrick Doherty asked whether he was pleading guilty to four of the seven counts of human smuggling of which he'd been accused, he answered yes. In a twist, however, the court heard one of the outstanding counts was still in dispute and may yet proceed to trial. Federal Crown Prosecutor Ryan Carrier said that the Canada Border Services Agency was working to arrange travel for a key witness who lives in China. A sentencing hearing for Mr. Kong won't happen until that outstanding count is resolved, perhaps in a few weeks. The offenses to which Mr. Kong had pleaded carry a mandatory sentence of 3 years in jail. If the Crown can prove that the crime was committed for profit or in association with or for the benefit of organized crime, the Crown is seeking a sentence that exceeds the minimum. Kong's defense lawyer is possibly looking for to challenge that minimum in court. A mandatory minimum sentence of 3 years for people smuggling. Weighing in for the first time since the National Post revealed last month the years-long investigation into suspicious activity at Peace Arch Park, federal immigration critic for the Conservative Party, Michelle Rempel, said Kong's case reinforces a recurring narrative about management at the border. The message Canadians are getting is that the border isn't secure and the government isn't maintaining the integrity of our border, she said. And as I give you the details about this, you'll absolutely shake your head in disbelief. According to the search warrant application obtained by the National Post, Canada Border Service Agency investigators allege the smuggling operation followed a general pattern. Chinese nationals flew to the U.S. on valid travel visas, made their way to Seattle, and then got dropped off at or near Peace Arch Park. About a 40-acre park that straddles the international border between Surrey, British Columbia, which is a suburb of Vancouver, and Blaine, Washington. So it's a park that straddles the border. There are no physical barriers in the park, and as long as they stay within its boundaries, visitors are free to walk back and forth without a passport. Once the illegals walked across the border, someone waiting for them on the Canadian side would guide them to a vehicle, court records show. An email uncovered during the investigation
and translated from Chinese, instructed would-be border jumpers to smile and be natural when walking through the park and to pretend to take pictures. I've actually been in that park, and the border between Canada, the suburb of Surrey, British Columbia, and the United States is really a curb, as I recall. In other words, there is no barrier, there's no fence. So the way this would work, the Chinese illegals would come from Seattle up to the border, to the Peace Park, the Peace Arch Park, and then get off on the American side, and they could walk across the grass and I think over the small little curb, and they're in Canada. No security. Well, they're supposed to stay within the park, but there's no fence around the park in Canada, and so they would simply walk on. They would be there'd be a car waiting for them, and they'd be in Canada. Now, I found this out 10 years ago, and then many Vancouver's locals know about it, which means the Canadian authorities had to know about it. There's no secret here. I mean, this is not some amazing hidden passage that they found. This is right out there and available. And so they would simply cross. The question, of course, has to be, why was that not secured years ago? And you have to conclude that the Canadian authorities just aren't serious. They don't want to protect the border. They don't want to keep people out who haven't gone through legitimate channels. It just isn't a priority. This is incompetence at best, but I would argue treason. And these illegals were even given instructions to act natural, smile, take pictures, pretend you're a tourist. While Kong, now he's the one who pleaded guilty, while Kong had a hands-on role in the initial stages of the operation, the task of drop-offs and pickups was eventually delegated to others, according to investigators. But Kong was still involved in helping the illegals obtain airplane tickets and transporting them to the airport, court records say. Many of the illegals ended up filing refugee claims at an inland government office in Etobicoke, a suburb of Toronto, now, which is, you know, two-thirds of the way across the country. Vancouver's on the west coast. Toronto is opposite Rochester, New York, on Lake Ontario, so two-thirds of the way across the country. The investigation culminated last September with the arrest of Kong, a former sawmill worker. He was charged under Section 117 of the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act with 7 counts related to human smuggling between 2014 and 2015, involving 34 illegals. Some of them children. Kong's adult son, Matthew, was also arrested last year and faces lesser charges under the same act. He has pleaded not guilty. Electronic ledgers, or score sheets, found on a computer in Michael Kong's home listed the names of more than 800 foreign nationals believed to have been smuggled between 2011 and 2016, according to the investigation. Of those listed, about one-third were found to have filed refugee claims in Canada, while a few were smuggled into the U.S. The whereabouts of the others is not known. When the Post tried to determine who on the Canadian side was responsible for patrolling the park, authorities couldn't seem to agree. I mean, this is like a joke. The Royal Canadian, the CBSA, that's the Canadian Border Services Agency, said it was the RCMP, or Royal Canadian Mounted Police's responsibility. However, the RCMP said Peace Arch Park was a collaborative layered responsibility that is patrolled in partnership with CBSA, the Surrey RCMP, and an RCMP federal unit. I just love the meaningless bureaucraties. The patrolling the park was a collaborative layered responsibility. It means we work together. Several groups are involved, and quite clearly, it wasn't being patrolled. The two agencies that would seem to be involved, Canadian Border Services Agency or the Border Guards, said it was the Maori's responsibility. The Maori said, well, it was a shared responsibility. Well, clearly, it was not being they were not effectively patrolling it. If dozens, and that's what the evidence seems to suggest, dozens, perhaps hundreds of illegals have crossed over just to this network. Such finger pointing is unacceptable and a symptom of the government's lack of clear direction on managing the border. This is what the Conservative Party, Michelle Rempel, said. The fact that there are two federal ministers, Ralph Goodale, the Minister of Public Safety, and Bill Blair, whose responsibilities include the border, has created confusion, she added. And confusion that should have been resolved years ago. You know, every organization goes through problems, and sometimes there appear to be shared responsibilities or conflict as to who's in charge. Well, those are situations that in any healthy organization gets sorted out. There's nothing new about this. So why was it not sorted out? Because, and this is the conclusion you have to come to, because it was simply not a priority with the government. Rempel said a loophole in a border agreement between Canada and the U.S. needs to be closed to discourage illegals from jumping the border from the U.S. Under the Safe Third Party Agreement, asylum seekers cannot seek refugee protection in Canada if they have arrived at a Canadian port of entry from a safe country such as the United States. However, that rule does not apply to asylum seekers who enter Canada in between ports of entry. Well, that's only because that's the way the government chooses to interpret it. The clear spirit of the Third Safe Country Agreement is this. If you, both Canada and the United States, consider the other a safe country for refugees, that is, for a legitimate claim. So, the idea is, if you come to the United, you have to apply for refugee status in the first country you come to. So, if a person is in the United States, like these Chinese who had come on legitimate tourist visas to the United States, and if they want to make a refugee claim, they must make that claim in the United States. And conversely, if a person comes to Canada, they must make that refugee claim in Canada and not try to boogie on down to the United States. That's what it means. Now, the government, because we've now had over 43,000 illegals pour across the border from up in New York City into the province of Quebec at a place called the Roxham Road. They still haven't built a wall there or a fence. What the government has chosen to do is to is to state that, well, we don't know where these people come from. Well, which of course is just ridiculous. Of course, we know where they came from. They didn't jump on a pogo stick in Mexico and give a couple of pushes and fly right across the continental United States and land in Canada. And nor did they fall out of an airplane. So I mean, it's quite clear where they came from. They came from the United States, where they were obligated, should they wish to make a refugee claim, to make that claim there, not to board or hop into Canada. That was the clear intent of the treaty. And to read it any other way, to say, well, you know, this wasn't a designated border crossing, so we don't know where they came from, so they can make a refugee claim. But this absolutely subverts the clear intention of the legislation and of the treaty. But that's what the Trudeau government has been doing at least going back to the 2016, when they started coming in this fashion, and it's the fault of the government, the fault in the sense that they simply wish to read the act in this bizarre way, so that they don't in fact have to enforce it. That's what it's all about. It's an effort to get as many of these people into Canada as possible. And this is something that we in the immigration reform movement have been fighting. It's absolutely bloody-minded government policy to let as many of them in as they possibly can. In law, there's a rule that you look at the intentions of the law. You know, and in fact, they always do that in a court case. That it might go back to the passage of the law. Well, what was the intentions of Parliament? If there's an ambiguity in a law, that question is asked. What was the intention? Well, it's quite clear what the intention was. The intention was to the rule is that you would have to apply in the first country you come to, and this is to prevent precisely what we're seeing, and that's what's sometimes called asylum shopping. But nonetheless, the government has permitted this to go on. That only encourages more. And the article concludes, this is the Conservative Party's critic, Michelle Rempel. She concludes, she cited an Auditor General's report that said the wait times for the processing of refugee claims could increase to 5 years by 2024. I mean, the system is absolutely jammed and backlogged. A spokesman for, another cabinet minister, Bill Blair, said Monday that she could not talk about the individual cases, but said the government was making investments to maintain our system's fairness by processing up to 50,000 claims per year and removing those not fleeing war and persecution in a timely manner. Well, we'll believe it when we see it. Well, this is Paul Fromm. You're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. I'm going to take my musical break right now, and I'm going to play a singer that those of you with long memories thinking back to the television program Hee Haw probably remember, and that's singer Buck Owens. And this is Buck and his group, the Buckaroos. He's been dead a few years, but he was a great entertainer. These are some songs by Buck Owens, who of course brought helped establish the the Bakersfield Sound, Bakersfield, California.
They're gonna put me in the movies. They're gonna make a big star out of me. We'll make a film about a man that's sad and lonely. And all I gotta do is act naturally. Well, I'll bet you
I'm gonna live here again. Just the kind that fit my dreams and plans. Now the
of you. My tears have stopped falling. The long, lonely nights are now at an end. The key to my heart you hold in your hand, and nothing else matters. We're together again.
And this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the Fighting Side of Me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern Time. The show is repeated at 8 in the morning and 4 in the afternoon. All of those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the Fighting Side of Me here on White Resistance Radio.
caviar from Britain's shore. Would the dauntless hero came and planted firm Britannia's flag on Canada's fair domain. Here may it wave our boast, our pride, and joined in love together the thistle, shamrock, rose, and twine, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. At Queenston Heights and Lundy's Lane, our brave fathers side by side for freedom, homes, and loved ones dear, firmly stood and nobly died. And those dear rights which they maintained, we swear to yield them never. Our watchword evermore shall be the maple leaf forever. Our lot and plenteous